If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble. With exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Rob Attar. By the end of 1945, the wartime alliance between the US, Britain and France on one side and the Soviet Union on the other was beginning to fracture, and the city at the centre of these escalating tensions was Berlin. In his new book, Checkmate in Berlin, The Cold War Showdown That Shaped the Modern World, the author Giles Milton reveals how rising suspicion and acrimony between Stalin, Truman, Churchill and Attlee led to diplomatic flashpoints, the Berlin airlift and the formation of NATO. Here, in conversation with our production editor Spencer Mizzen, Giles discusses how the battle for control of Berlin in the second half of the 1940s fired the starting gun on the Cold War.
Giles, your new book, Checkmate in Berlin, tells the story of the Allies' scramble to exert control over the German capital at the climax of the Second World War, an episode that fired the starting gun on the Cold War. Now, you've written books on D-Day, British guerrilla warfare campaigns in the Second World War, espionage battles against Lenin's Russia. Now, why did you now decide to turn your attention to this particular episode in history?
Well, I found it fascinating that there are so many hundreds of books published each year about the Second World War, and yet almost no one writes about the immediate post-war period. So the period from 1945 to 1949. And I think this is it's an incredibly important period, because really what happens in those few years sets the shape of Europe and the world for decades to come. So I felt that there was a story to be told, a very powerful story of geopolitics, which is focused on this fantastic battle for the sort of the heart and soul of Berlin, the broken capital of Germany.
Now, as you just mentioned there, this is a critical period in 20th century history. What made Berlin such a prize to the victorious Allies? Why was gaining control of this city so important to what unfolded over the subsequent 10, 20 years?
Well, you really have to go back to the Yalta Conference in February 1945, where the big three meet. So you've got Stalin, Roosevelt and Churchill. They meet in the Crimea really to thrash out the post-war global order. You know, who's going to get what? But by the time, of course, the war comes to an end, the Red Army, Stalin's army, is victorious over huge areas of Eastern Europe and Central Europe. And also much of Germany as well. They've, of course, got into Berlin way before the Americans and the British. But it has been agreed that Germany's going to be divided up. So the Soviets are going to get the east of the country, and the Americans and the British are going to get the west of the country. They're going to do the same with Berlin, the German capital. So likewise, the Soviets get the east of the city, and the Americans and Brits will get the west of the city. But there's a major problem. Anyone looking at a map can see there is one big problem with this plan, and that is that Berlin lies in the very heart of Soviet-occupied Germany. So this city is going to become a sort of symbolic of the great clash that's going to occur between the Soviets and the Western allies, who it was hoped at the Yalta Conference that this great wartime alliance would continue into the post-war period. And that's what Washington and Whitehall really wanted to happen. But it's not long before tensions begin to build, and it's clear that All of those tensions post-war are really going to be focused on the former German capital.
Now, you quote Robert Heinz, the deputy military governor of the British sector of Berlin, observing that the city was on the brink of the worst scourge of disease and pestilence since the Middle Ages. Now, how bad a state was the city and its population in at the end of the war?
Well, you've got to remember that Berlin is a city in total ruins. You know, the RAF, the Americans, they've been bombing it from the air for several years, intensely. And then you've had the Red Army has come in and just, mortared and shelled the city. So it's a city in ruins. There's no city administration, no functioning government. There's no water, there's no gas, there's no electricity, and there's almost no food. So and all the hospitals have been destroyed completely. So it's a city, and people are living in ruins, in their basements, in the cellars. It's an absolute, humanitarian disaster in the waiting. And so when both the Soviets move into their sector of the city and the Western allies into their sectors, they've got an absolute disaster to deal with. They've got, in the Western sectors alone, they've got 2.5 million Berliners who are starving, and they've got to bring food in, and they've got to bring it in pretty quickly.
So how did they go about dealing with that? And how quickly did they deal with it?
Well, one of the first problems that they face is, of course, that the Soviet army, the Red Army, has captured Berlin and got there 2 months before the Western allies. So the Soviets already control the whole city by the time they deign to allow the Western allies into their sectors. The Soviets have done what they can, and they've done quite a good job at repairing water supplies and some electricity supplies in their sector of the city, but they have declined to do anything in the Western sectors except, of course, loot those sectors and take away whatever they can. So when the Americans and the British arrive in their sectors, not only is there no water, no electricity, no gas supplies, as I've said, but also they find that all the great industrial factories, many of which are in the British sector, have been totally looted. The Soviets have simply carted off everything, as they see it, for reparations for all the damage that the German army has done to Soviet Russia, of course. So they walk into an absolute disaster, basically.
One of the things that really struck me about when I was reading the opening chapters of the book was how in the opening diplomatic exchanges between the Soviets and the Western allies, I mean, it seems to me that, from reading your book, that Stalin totally ran rings around his Western counterparts from Yalta onwards, when he extracted territorial gains at the expense of Japan and established control over swathes of Eastern Europe. He seemed to get pretty much everything he wanted. I mean, is that a fair assessment? And if so, why were the Western allies, why did they misjudge the Soviets so completely at the beginning?
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. And I think both at Yalta and at the Potsdam Conference, I mean, Stalin ran rings around. Well, first of all, at Yalta, of course, it was Churchill and Roosevelt. He really got everything he wanted. But then you've got to remember, Stalin was in a very powerful position because his Red Army was already controlling much of the territory that he coveted. So, you know, he wanted great chunks of Poland. Well, his troops were already sitting inside those, you know, chunks of territory. But it also has to be said that I think certainly Churchill did not perform well at either Yalta or at Potsdam. And, you know, I've read all the diaries of the of the key players. So you've got people like Anthony Eden, you've got people like Sir Alexander Cadogan, who were at these conferences. And in their letters and diaries, they say that Churchill was simply not on form. You know, he hadn't read his briefs. He was drinking heavily. As Cadogan put it, he was drinking buckets of Caucasian champagne. And I think Stalin had a very clear idea of what he wanted. He had very good aides and advisors with him, and he indeed did get what he wanted. And in fact, after the Potsdam Conference, the Soviet diplomats, they couldn't quite believe that they got everything. The British were hampered at Potsdam by one major problem, and that was the British general election occurred in the middle of the Potsdam Conference. And it took several weeks to count the votes because, of course, you know, all the troops were overseas still, so they had to count all those votes. Halfway through the conference, Churchill discovers he's lost the election. And this is not great for your negotiating team, where halfway through, you've got a new prime minister coming in and a new foreign secretary, the pugnacious Ernest Bevin. And so I think that also really helped Stalin to get what he wanted.
I mean, you just mentioned Ernest Bevin, and I think you say in your book that Stalin was a little bit wary of him, wasn't he? And how did the British stance change after Attlee and Bevin came in?
Yeah, I think had Bevin been there from the beginning, there might have been a slightly different outcome. Bevin arrived at Potsdam, said, "I'm not going to have Britain barged about." You know, he was a heavyweight, and he was determined to take on Stalin. But, you know, as one commentator said, you know, the term, the big three, the magic had gone. The conference was near its end already. And I think really there was not much that Attlee and Bevin could do by that point. You know, it was too late. But very importantly, Potsdam gave Bevin the chance to meet Stalin. And from the moment he met him, he did not trust him. And really, this would become a hallmark of Bevin's foreign policy, that this guy, He's not a leader you can do business with, you know. So already you see the wartime alliance beginning to fracture in Bevin's own mind.
Why were the Soviets so hostile to the Western Allies from the beginning? I mean, were they preparing for another war?
I think that Stalin had very fixed ideas about what he wanted and was determined to get it. And of course, Churchill wanted to install a pro-Western government in Poland. For Stalin, this was an absolutely sort of matter of principle that he was going to install his own puppet government in Poland. So I think that Stalin had clear ideas of what he wanted. Of course, Churchill was very anti-communist, anti-Stalin from the outset. And I mentioned in the book a quite remarkable blueprint for war that Churchill set in motion in the spring of 1945. At the very end of the Second World War, Churchill asks his military planners to plan for a massive military attack on the Soviet Union. It's called Operation Unthinkable. And, you know, all the files are still in the National Archives. And it's a detailed plan for the Americans and British to attack the Soviet Union. It's quite extraordinary. This is sort of World War III being declared, you know, before, just at the very end of World War II.
What example of the sort of tensions between the two sides and the Soviet attitude to the Western allies was Stalin's avowals that Adolf Hitler was still alive, I think you might have said possibly in British-held territory, and all the while Stalin had confirmation that the German leader was in fact dead, and he was so determined to sort of spin this story that Hitler was still alive that he had the person who confirmed Hitler's dead locked up in a gulag so the truth couldn't leak out. I mean, why was Stalin so hell-bent on misleading the Allies on this point?
Yeah, this is absolutely extraordinary. When you read what happened is the Soviets found the grisly, charred corpse of Hitler. And most importantly, they found the jaw, his jawbone, and they had his teeth. So they found the dental nurse that looked after Hitler's teeth. And she was able to find the radiographs of his teeth and prove without a shadow of a doubt that this was Hitler's corpse. And this was, yeah, told to Stalin, who immediately saw this as a potential way of, you know, getting one over on the Allies, but on the Western Allies. So, yeah, he had it absolutely hushed up, the fact that Hitler was indeed had committed suicide and his body has been burnt. And he started to insinuate that the British were holding a still alive Hitler in their zone of occupied Germany. It's an extraordinary accusation to make against your supposed ally, you know. And this would be repeated time and again. And it just made the British look really, really bad because they couldn't offer any proof, really. So this story ran and run, and Stalin was very happy to let it run and run.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
This is where Ernest Bevin played a major role, really, is the decision that the Western countries need to form some sort of defensive alliance, that really, that the Soviets really only understand strength.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Looking to invest? Start your journey by exploring exchange-traded funds with GlobalX ETFs. Exchange-traded funds, or ETFs for short, create baskets of stocks, bonds, and other assets that you can buy in a single trade. GlobalX specializes in ETFs that track emerging trends, like the rise of artificial intelligence, as well as strategies aimed to generate income potential. Visit GlobalXETFs.com to discover how you can get started.
Now, I think the two of the most intriguing characters in your book are Frank Cowlin Mad Howley, one of the leading US soldiers and negotiators in the city, and his British counterpart, Robert Hind. They seemed to take quite a different approach to negotiations, didn't they? Howley was a far more combative, sort of shoot-from-the-hip operator, who described the Soviets as liars, swindlers, and cutthroats, while Hind was a bit more, well, I'd be right in saying, a bit more buttoned up and conventional. How did they rub along? I mean, they do seem to have made the relationship work, don't they?
They do. So Brigadier Robert Looney Hind, to give him the full phrase, he's a real product of British India, you know, product of the Raj, and he's going to come in and run the British sector rather like he's the umpire of a cricket match. You know, it's all about fair play and decent treatment and everything. Very sort of old school British, and he very much sees himself and his men as standard bearers for the empire. You know, they're flying the Union Jack, and you know, it's all going to be fair minded. By contrast, Colonel Frank Howling Mad Howley, as you said, he's coming in to run the American sector of Berlin. And Howley really is a sort of guy. He's an action man. He's a cowboy in a way. And he believes in getting things done. You know, there's going to be no red tape. There's going to be no rules unless they're his own. And he's going to get the American sector up and running as quickly as possible. Now, these two men, they've actually trained together for this job, because originally it was going to be a joint British-American operation, the running of the Western sectors, but they eventually divide into their two sort of respective military governments, if you like. So with Brigadier Hind in the British sector, Howley in the American sector, and they are chalk and cheese. And really, it was expected that these two men would never, ever get along. But actually, they got along incredibly well. They had a real respect for each other's differences, I think. And although Howley was forever talking about these, you know, fuddy-duddy Brits who've come out of British India, they managed to form a very good working relationship. But there was a slight difference in policy in the sense that while Hind was going to carry out Whitehall's policy to the letter, and that meant getting on with the Soviets, Howley took a very different approach. The moment he arrived in Berlin, as he actually says in his diary, he said, "I came to Berlin thinking the Germans were the enemy, and I very soon realised that the Russians were now the enemy." And so from day one, almost, he's in there and he's looking over towards the east of the city and thinking, these guys cannot be trusted.
And didn't that also lead him into conflict with his superiors as well?
Yeah, this is where it gets really fascinating, because Frank Howley, basically, he begins to form his own sort of freewheeling anti-Soviet policy within the American sector of Berlin, whereas Washington, they want to do absolutely the opposite. They're desperate to keep on good terms with Stalin. So you could see him really as a rogue operator. I mean, the Soviets themselves called him the cowboy. And there is a touch of that about Frank Howley, that he's decided, forget what Washington say, he's going to do what he thinks is right.
So what did Berliners themselves make of the occupying forces? And how quickly did life change for them in the, say, four-year period that your book describes?
Well, at the very beginning, of course, so the Red Army comes in first. So the Russians are there for 2 months with no Americans and no Brits in the city. Berliners are desperate for the Western Allies to arrive because, of course, the Soviets, I mentioned, they've been looting, but also they've been raping. I mean, the accounts of rapes they're pretty grim to read, it has to be said. Some 90,000 Berlin women had to have medical treatment for rapes at the hand of the Red Army. But the number of rapes is known to be infinitely higher than that. So not only have you got the absolute chaos and humanitarian catastrophe of the city, but you've also got a huge number of very traumatized people, women living in the city. So they're desperate for the Americans and Brits to arrive. And of course, when the Americans and Brits do arrive, they're just desperate that where they're living is going to fall within the Western sectors of the city, the Western occupied sectors of the city. It's, of course, it's a slightly weird situation because the city's been divided up, but it's not like there's boundary lines and everything. What happens is the three powers, and of course the French will soon come in as well and take their bit of the city, they all start erecting signs. And I'm sure many people listening to this will have seen pictures, you know, "You're now leaving the American sector." That all began in July 1945, when the three powers were ensconced in the city. The dividing lines were marked up like that. And of course, while each power was running its sector of the city, you can't run a major capital city you can't just divide it up like that. You also have to have some sort of central body that's controlling the city as a whole as well.
The second half of your book is dominated by the Berlin Airlift, something you describe as a siege. This operation saw the Allies transporting hundreds of thousands of tons of supplies into West Berlin after the Soviets had choked off railroad and canal access to the city. I mean, how enormous a logistical undertaking was this?
So absolutely everything needed by the Western sectors of Berlin has had to be brought in by road or rail. And of course, when the Soviets shut off the road and rail links, that leaves only the air. They've negotiated these air corridors. But here's the problem. The Western sectors of Berlin, so 2.4 million people, to keep them alive every day requires 13,500 tons of supplies. As an absolute minimum, it's calculated an absolute subsistence minimum, the Western sectors require 4,500. That would just about keep the population off starvation. A Dakota plane, which is the kind of workhorse plane that they have access to, can carry 2,500 tons in any given flight. So it is logistically impossible to supply 2.5 million people with a few Dakota planes bringing in 2.5 tons of food at a time, or so it's thought. But in Berlin, there's this rather brilliant British boffin called Air Commodore Reginald Rex Waite, he's called. And he's a classic sort of boffin figure, brilliant mathematician. You know, he's always got his slide rule playing around with maths and mathematical equations. And he sits down and tries to work out, actually, could it be possible to do this? And he sees there's 8 airfields in Western Germany, and there are 2 airfields in the Western sectors of Berlin. And he works out that if you basically you have planes flying round the clock on numerous different levels in the sky, landing every 90 seconds into these 2 airfields, you could just about, it was just about feasible to supply the city, you know, and keep people alive. But he thinks you could probably only do that for a few weeks. This is not a long-term proposition. He puts it to the British commandant. The British commandant says it's ridiculous. He puts it to the British governor of Western occupied Germany. He says, don't be ridiculous. This can't be done. He takes it to the Americans, and the Americans say, you know what? We'll have a go at this. And thus the airlift is born.
And what kind of signal did this send to the Soviets, the fact that the Allies were prepared to take this like massive logistical undertaking on and pull it off? I mean, did that take the Soviets by surprise to a certain extent?
The Soviets simply thought this was impossible. Stalin thought that there's no way the Allies would be able to pull this off, partly because they had intimate knowledge of the siege of Stalingrad, where the Luftwaffe had tried to supply Paulus and his men, his troops there, with an airlift, and it had failed miserably. So Stalin was very, very confident that that the airlift would fail, and basically he could starve the Western sectors of Berlin into submission. And he really, I think he didn't quite realise just how much the Western allies would throw at this. So as soon as they've decided that the airlift is, they've given it the green light, basically, planes start arriving from all across the world. So Americans have got airfields in, you know, Hawaii, Honolulu, Alaska, everywhere. They start bringing in planes. And the British, likewise, from the colonies, dominions all over the world, they bring the planes into Germany. And it becomes clear they're really going to have a crack at this and try and make it work. You know, everything has to be flown in. It's not just food. We're talking about fuel, everything, you know, petrol, even salt has to be flown in. You know, they need, I don't know how many tons of salt a day needs to be flown in. That's very difficult. You can't fill a plane full of salt because it will drop down into the fuselage and corrode all the cables. What do the British do? They bring in Sunderlands, which land on the water. All the cables, because it lands on water, the cables are in the roof of the plane. So they are able to carry salt. So they think of everything. They use food ways a lot. So they bring in dried food, powdered food. Everything is powdered. But it means they can bring in just enough to keep the population alive.
To what extent was the formation of NATO the product of what went on in Berlin in the few years before the treaty was signed?
I think there are two really important things that need to be mentioned that happened in the spring of 1946. The first is, famously, Winston Churchill gives his Iron Curtain speech. And he, in that speech, which is given in America with Truman's blessing, in fact, with Truman at his side, President Truman at his side, he sets out that the Soviets are trying to dominate Eastern, Central, and possibly even Western Europe. It's a real rallying cry, call to arms, that everything has changed. And this sort of awakens the Western world to what's going on. Because Churchill says, look at what they're doing. They've taken over all the great capitals of Eastern Europe. That's one thing. Second thing happens just a few days, actually, after Churchill's speech. The news is announced that one of the staff members at the Soviet embassy in Canada has defected to the West. And with that defection, he brings a whole sheath of documents setting out that the Soviets have a massive espionage program in North America, and they're trying to infiltrate the American nuclear program. These two things, I think, stun the Western world. And it makes President Truman and Attlee realize that Stalin is no, that wartime alliance is over. Stalin cannot be trusted. And out of these two events and other things that happen as well, and particularly things that are happening on the ground in Berlin, you have two things. You have the Truman Doctrine, and the Truman Doctrine sets out that any country threatened by the Soviet Union or by communism will be protected by the Americans. And the second thing that happens is you have the Marshall Plan. This is the great plan of George Marshall, which is essentially to rebuild Germany, Western Germany, and rebuild Europe. And these two things really are throwing down the gauntlet to the Soviet Union. They're suddenly saying, okay, we're going to do exactly what we need to do in our sphere of influence, basically. And so at that point in 1946, I think the post-war world really begins to change.
Sure. And so your book ends with the formation of NATO. How would you describe the balance of power between the Soviets and the Western allies at this point?
Yeah, so all the while throughout 46, 47, 48, foreign ministers are meeting, they're talking, they're looking at what's going on. And they realize, as I say, that the Soviets can't be trusted. And gradually, and this is where Ernest Bevin played a major role, really, is the decision that the Western countries need to form some sort of defensive alliance, that really, that the Soviets really only understand strength. This is what Frank Howley has been saying from the perspective of Berlin, that these guys are gangsters and you have to treat them like gangsters and you have to be really tough on them. And so this gets built into Western foreign policy, the idea of bringing together the signatory countries of what will be NATO. And the central tenet of NATO is going to be that an attack on one country is an attack on all of them. And this changes everything, really, because the Soviets now know if they push, themselves too far into Western Europe, they're going to have the entire Western world attacking them. And thus really begins the Cold War at this point. This is where the great standoff that's going to last for decades. In response to NATO, of course, you get the Soviet Union forming the Warsaw Pact. And at that point, the world has split into two, giant and very hostile opposing camps.
And finally, Giles, what lessons do you think this episode in history, what lessons do you think it holds for us today? I mean, to what extent do we still live in the shadow of what occurred in Berlin in the second half of the 1940s?
Well, I think, if you look at our British relations with Russia today, I mean, they're not exactly friendly. And I think that the West has to respond extremely strongly to anything that Russia does. I think, they're right to impose sanctions when Putin plays all sorts of games. I think, Frank Howley in many ways is right that you simply have to stand up to this. You cannot afford to be to allow them to roll over you, because once you give in on one thing, they'll take the next thing. It's very interesting reading, Howley wrote a book of his time in Berlin. It was written, early 1950s. And you think some things are still immensely applicable to today's situation.
That was Giles Milton. Checkmate in Berlin, the Cold War showdown that shaped the modern world, was published by Hodder and Stoughton in May. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Ewart, Jack Bateman and Brittany Colley. Join us tomorrow for a discussion about the Klondike goldfields.